Good morning. Medical marijuana licensees are closer to being able to plant their crops. Meanwhile, one organization says it's working to close the decriminalization gap. Carl Berquist of the Drug Policy Forum joins us later in the hour. And policies to protect the environment may be getting a rollback in Washington, but in Hawaii, the Governor's Environmental Council report says it wants to shift the paradigm of measuring sustainability. Council Chair Joseph Shackett explains why it's now Ocean Ohia Ohana. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. The Kumukuhua production of buffalo proceeds from a historical irony. African-American soldiers set against Filipinos in the Spanish-American War. And we'll talk with Nature Conservancy scientist and cultural advisor Dr. Sam Ahugan.
It's Wednesday, January 25th. That's The Conversation, right after this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Many reasons to be in doubt about the future of the EPA and not too many ways to find out.
Well, not today.
Not today, anyway.
As you may have heard a little earlier, today the Environmental Protection Agency is under a media blackout and it's also suspended from awarding any new grants or issuing orders. Now, as the Trump administration is getting its EPA on message, locally, the Governor's Environmental Council recently issued a message of its own in its annual report. Hawaii's paradigm of measuring sustainability should shift, and it boils down to three words, Ocean Ohia Ohana, or maybe more appropriately, a genuine progress indicator. Okay, that's six words. Anyway, Council Chair Joseph Shackett is in our studio to explain it all. Good morning. Good to see you again.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about the fact that you have that nexus of the genuine progress indicator with these three areas that were called out in the new report. People clearly have been hearing lots about ocean for a long time. Clearly bringing it down to individuals, families, the Ohana part. But the fact that Ohia was called out and is right there in the title, we know what's been happening with Ohia. But why pull out Ohia aside from the alliterative value?
So with Ohia, the rapid Ohia death obviously has been a big concern amongst people in the state as far as
There are little fire ants and other things too.
And that's kind of the point. There's all kinds of threats to our biosecurity and what that's going to impacts that'll have on not just our ecosystem, but our agricultural products that are produced here and our general kind of well-being, I guess. They're all tied together in a way that you need to really call out and say, hey, we need to look at biosecurity and issues of invasive species and make sure we're addressing it properly.
Because today it's Ohia and tomorrow it's going to be something else.
Right.
So as you begin to look at those areas, along with what we see happening with the ocean, clearly how we are being asked to take individual responsibility. I want to ask you about this too, because earlier in the month we talked to Dr. Bob Richman, and he said something that we all found quite stunning. He said, when you look at the kind of runoff that we see from land, we have the worst system for drainage I've ever seen anywhere in the world. If you wanted to design a system to kill coastal reefs, you couldn't do better than Hawaii. I mean, tying that back to the ocean part of it, how did the council view those kinds of sentiments, which clearly you've heard before?
Yeah. So one of the big challenges is we have relatively limited tax dollars, obviously. And how do you spend that money to improve the environment, to improve our well-being, safety and security, all the kind of major things you need for a prosperous economy? And it's difficult to make those decisions because there's trade-offs always. Am I going to spend this money to improve this road, or is that going to have some other detrimental effect? And the way that we think we should be looking at this is through this genuine progress indicator. And what that does is it allows you to look at economic activity and not just say, well, we spent money on, you know, there was a transaction that occurred that generated revenue or that is a sign of economic activity, which is good. But there might be unintended consequences of that action, of that money being spent, and allows us to kind of look at a more holistic approach to spending spending and policy, I guess.
For a lot of people, hearing the idea of a genuine progress indicator is difficult to wrap their minds around. The idea that these things that may be somewhat intangible actually have a dollar value. And how do you affix some sort of monetary value to something that may be a consequence or may not be a consequence? But you're saying at least that lens should be included along with things like the GDP.
Yeah, and a good example to kind of put some a real visual of what the GPI does. If you look at, for example, a large oil spill where you might spend millions or hundreds of millions of dollars to clean it up, under the traditional gross domestic product or gross state product, you would see that as a positive because you're spending money, there's economic activity. But from a genuine progress perspective, you would be able to subtract out the negatives of that, which is the ecological damage from the oil spill, the damages as far as tourism, a state's or a community's reputation, and things like that. It would allow you to really tease all that out and balance the economic activity with the negative consequences of that.
But most people, when they hear things like oil spill, they do have that negative reaction to it, and they know that there are going to be all of those impacts. In this way, you're able to put some value to that, but it doesn't necessarily get to the well-being at the get-go, because obviously you're in reactive mode when something like that happens.
Right.
So how then do you take the genuine progress indicator and move that into a litmus test, if you will, before you begin certain activities, like, for example, some of what we talked about with the water just a moment ago, when you're thinking about, okay, if you're going to have a lot of development here, are you really looking at it through the lens of well-being, which many of the scientists that we've talked to have said, you know, that's something we could control.
Well, you know, with the water issue in particular, you know, right now the city and county of Honolulu is spending very large sums of money in the billions of dollars to upgrade wastewater treatment facilities. Most of that's driven by federal mandates. But there's also the question of, is this the best use of those many, many hundreds of millions of dollars? Would we be better off focusing on non-point source pollution? Whereas the wastewater treatment plant outfall is fairly far offshore. And I hate to use the dilution is the solution to pollution kind of meme. But in some cases, if we want to really have an impact on nearshore water quality, you might get more bang for the buck by spending that money on the coastal lands or looking at runoff issues rather than a deep ocean outfall. So with the GPI, it would allow you to analyze that economic decision and incorporate multiple perspectives on it as far as the actual benefit or cost.
Very clearly, from all the things that you've just said, looking at all of this through the GPI is not going to be the view from Washington. How, with this very changed political climate, are you and those in Hawaii advising the governor and how much strength putting into several of the initiatives that we've seen that have been called out in the environmental report?
Well, we don't have a lot of direct impact on what happens in Washington as a state environmental council, but the state does have a prosperous economy, and it does have its own spending power, if you will. So if we can set an example in Hawaii for making decisions and looking at economic activity from a holistic perspective, we would join several other states like Vermont and Maryland and others that are doing a similar kind of thing. And the way I think you get change in Washington is start local, and that's what we need to do.
Which goes back to the whole idea that this is an opportunity for Hawaii to stand by its values. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll talk to you again.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you. Joseph Shackett is the volunteer chairperson of the Environmental Council for the state of Hawaii. In his work life, he's the environmental compliance manager for Grace Pacific. He's advocated for improving environmental performance in the construction industry at the local and national levels. The recently released Environmental Annual Report is on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a kumukahua drama of buffalo soldiers fighting in the Philippines. But first, your quiz. For today's backyard quiz, we got to thinking about the days when newspapers of all kinds were thriving in the islands. The one we're thinking of today was a weekly from 1865 to 1893 and a semi-weekly from 1894 to 1918. It was a constant advocate for American business interests that reported on four Hawaiian monarchs, the overthrow of the Hawaiian kingdom, the annexation of Hawaii to the United States, and the establishment of the territory of Hawaii. When U.S. economic interests were in line with those of the kingdom's rulers, it supported the monarchy, but when King Kalakaua began to question those interests in the mid-1870s, the paper went on the attack. From then on, it became a mouthpiece of the sugar barons and other members of the local oligarchy. When Queen Liliuokalani wrote her protests against the overthrow of the Hawaiian monarchy in January 1893, the paper refused to print it. This morning, we're looking for that paper's name. If you know, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 are the numbers to call. And the first one to get it right gets the prize.
Hi, good morning. I'm Roger Epstein from the Voyage of Aloha community. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
Black men sent to war against people of color. It has happened more than once in American history, and in an all but forgotten footnote to that history, it happened in the Philippines during the late 19th century exercise in territorial acquisition known as the Spanish-American War. That's when the legendary Buffalo Soldiers of the U.S. Cavalry were set against revolutionaries in the Philippines. It's the background to Buffaloed, a premier play at Kumukahua, and its author, Jeannie Baroga, is with us this morning. Good morning, Jeannie.
Good morning.
You obviously saw a great many historical ironies in this story. They're not hard to find, are they?
Oh, yeah. When I first came across that footnote I call in history, it just catapulted me into researching it more and more and coming up with a story that would make sense for this time and for my type of historical subject matters.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's set the stage. The Buffalo Soldiers were freed slaves set up in the U.S. Cavalry right after the Civil War.
Cavalry and infantry.
And infantry. Descendants of the so-called colored troops of the Civil War, right?
Right. And there's actual posters that recruited them. It said, fight for your own freedom, join us in the North and fight against the South. And that was the inception of the Buffalo Soldiers.
And they were sent to war against whom?
Well, after the Civil War, they were sent to fight Indians on the plains. And there were 38 reported wars against the Indians between the end of the Civil War and 1899 when they were sent over. So some of the wars they did fight in. And they were called Buffalo Soldiers because my version that I choose to espouse is that the Indians were impressed by their fighting abilities and named them after their favorite animal, Katanka, buffaloed. Though some people believe that the other idea was that it was because of their woolly hair.
Well, they ended up in the Philippines, and what was the situation in the Philippines when they were sent there?
Well, circuitously, first going through the Caribbean because of the bombing of the USS Maine, they were instrumental in actually saving Teddy Roosevelt's Rough Riders on San Juan. And they rescued them there, figured that, okay, they are such great fighters and they are brave and they can stand hot weather. They sent them to the Philippines, four companies. Two cavalry, two infantry, between June and November of 1899.
To fight against whom?
The Filipinos, who were trying to, again, regain control of their own country after over 300 years of rule by Spain.
So we were obviously on the side of the power structure, if you will.
Yes, because at that
we
point...
We wanted to be the power structure.
Yes, they wanted to be an imperialist nation like all the big boys, and Spain was fading. They couldn't monitor all the territories that they used to be able to. The Filipinos were particularly ferocious, let's say, in their resistance, and they said, we can't take this anymore. And so essentially there was a backdoor deal. The U.S. bought the Philippines from Spain for $20 million.
And then had to suppress a revolution.
Yeah, well, after telling them that, no, we're really fighting for you, and then realizing that, no, we've decided we'll be your protectorate. So there was a change of plans.
So in the play Buffaloed, members of the Buffalo Soldiers, black Americans, have second thoughts about their mission, right?
Yeah, because this was less than, well, it's just a little over 30 years from their own release, emancipation after a civil war, and they were questioned too by actual Filipinos saying that why are you doing this after you've just regained your own freedom to want to put yourself in a position of being responsible to inflict more slavery on people you don't even know.
Yeah. And what kind of records did you work from to you know, tell this story?
I actually found two large volumes of actual cable and telegrams between the U.S. military in D.C. and Manila during that particular period, 1899 to 1902. And a lot of them really list the number of casualties because they were dealing with scarlet fever, typhoid fever and malaria. And most of the men that they sent over, of the 126,000 that were sent over, were at least 40% in the hospital. So they were losing money. They were losing men. Dr. Walter Reed decided that that was the war he was going to make an example of how to treat foreign diseases, especially for the military. So he reduced it from 40% to about 15%.
But it was hard fighting. It was jungle fighting.
Oh, yeah.
It was tropical fighting. It was many kinds of fighting that we really, as a regular army, our cavalry, infantry or cavalry, had not seen.
Yeah, because they were fighting in the Caribbean and they realized there was a different way of fighting there because of the weather and even what they wore. The wool uniforms had to be replaced by light cotton duck material, which was funneled down to the colored soldiers after its use by the regular soldiers.
Yeah.
And so by the time they reached the Philippines, they were looking at a different way of fighting, a different way of what to wear, all sorts of things that are now, as I mentioned to you earlier, in the U.S. Marines manual on how to fight small wars. Mm-hmm. They learned a lot of that from the Philippine War for Independence, which is not the Spanish-American War.
Well, the internal conflicts of the Buffalo Soldiers themselves, you know, based in large part on their race, on their place in the society, are between doing well mm-hmm. as a member of the United States military.
Showing their muster and their proof.
And going against your conscience because, mm-hmm. you know, the Buffalo Soldiers are remembered as a heroic unit for their military successes.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So there are a lot of things to be proven, let's say, on their part, but also against their own moral fiber. This is a small number, as it is today, the reported defectors, they would call them defectors, and as opposed to deserters. It's interesting that the change of that term has morphed, let's
yeah.
say. Yeah.
Well, any number of dramatic ironies for you to work with in your play.
Mm-hmm. It was mid-1990s when I first started throwing notes in a folder, and probably another 10 years before I realized, okay, now is the time to really write it because I had other projects going on. But at that point, I approached a African-American artistic director in the Bay Area, and I said, we need to work together because I was the artistic director of Asian American Theater, mm-hmm. and it just seemed like a good fit. And when I asked him, I said, do you know about the Buffalo Soldiers in 1899 in the Philippines? He, like many others, said no.
Yeah.
So that to me was another reason to make it a subject worthy to tell on stage and spread more information about. It's a misunderstood war.
That it is. Thank mm-hmm. you so much, Jeannie.
Mm-hmm.
Jeannie Baroga is the author of Buffaloed, a Hawaii premiere play at Kumu Kahua that runs from January 26th till February 26th at Kumu Kahua Theater in downtown Honolulu.
Immigrant communities brace for a new reality.
Anyone who tells you that the core issue is the needs of those living here illegally has simply spent too much time in Washington.
Families hold on to their cash in case of deportation. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Very soon, Hawaii's 8 medical marijuana dispensaries will be able to plant their crops. And while it will still take almost half a year to make the final product available, tracking it from seed to sale can start next week. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
So here we are. It's been a long time since medical marijuana was legalized in 2000. It took until 2015 mm-hmm. until we got the dispensaries legalized. And you remember last year when they kept saying July and then it was, well, maybe by the end of the year?
Yeah.
This must be welcome news to those 8 dispensaries.
Well, it certainly is a milestone to celebrate this tracking software from seed to sale, as you put it. But you still got to grow the stuff, and it's probably going to take 5 months at least to cultivate for those who are ready to do this. But there's even more work to be done besides that. First, they got to test the software to make sure that it's working, and there's a number of other steps. So it's frustrating that it's taken so long. But for now, supporters of medical marijuana are starting to think finally their medicine will be available to them sometime this year. I would hate to come back a year from now and you and I talk about the same thing, but it does seem like finally some progress is being made.
So they're going to connect that seed-to-sale tracking software
right.
next week, and that really becomes the go-light, if you will, so that they can actually do the planting, and they're hoping that's going to happen reasonably simultaneously.
Yeah, and it may have been that hopes were too high, that it, so to speak, to get the thing up and running, because this is the first time we've ever done something like this, to implement this software, while Senator Ross Baker and others at the legislature have been disappointed that we haven't moved faster on this. Others say, look, it's taking time to get this right. Virginia Pressler, head of the health department, which is, of course, overseeing the program, says it does take time to do this and to make sure it works. Other steps along the way, you're going to have to actually test the product itself, the marijuana, before you sell it. There's still some training involved, both for Department of Health employees and probably some of those eight companies as well. You've also got to connect this system, this seed-to-sale software, to the actual existing patient registry in the state of Hawaii, because you want to make sure that you can confirm someone is indeed qualified. If they come up to buy the marijuana, they have to show a card, right? But they need to be able, and by they, I mean the dispensaries, need to be able to confirm that, in fact, they are entitled to the product.
So, I mean, really, hearing that long litany of things that have yet to be done,
yeah.
I mean, you got to wonder whether, the reality check is, okay, it looks good for the moment for next week, but wait a minute, that's going to take some time, especially they may be able to grow it, but whether that's going to really mean that the end user, the person who relies on the medical marijuana, is going to be able to have access to it in any, near term is really what's up in the air.
Right. And remember, these are businesses we're talking about. Anita Hofschneider, our reporter, did talk to one dispensary owner who says, these delays are costing us. So that's a concern as well, whether they can keep lasting long enough in order to be able to start turning around a profit on this. But for now, we can at least celebrate. And let's hope the software works, too. We've had our own challenges with software in the state in various areas involving the government. But
don't jinx
for now,
it.
Exactly. For now, February 1st being celebrated as a milestone, and hopefully we'll be able to bring some good news on this front for us shortly.
All right. And that will be a very welcome reality check. Thanks, Chad. Talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Bethan.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check. As we heard earlier in the program, the Department of Health seed-to-sale tracking software is supposed to be ready next week, and that would allow eight dispensaries in Hawaii that have been awarded the licenses to finally plant their crops. And that's good news for those who depend on medical marijuana, but one activist group wants to be sure that other issues surrounding marijuana aren't forgotten as well. The Drug Policy Forum of Hawaii will again support decriminalization in bills that look a lot like the ones we've seen over the last couple of years, the ones that failed in the end. Carl Berquist is the forum's executive director. He joins us now in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethan. Thank you for having me.
I want to talk to you a little bit about first some of the news that we got today, that milestone with the Department of Health saying that their tracking mechanism, the software that will track from seed to sale, which has been required, is pretty much ready to go, they hope, and that they'll be able to connect to that next week. You're part of the legislative oversight working group that was created last year. Did you know that this was coming?
Well, we've had three meetings so far, Bethann, and at each meeting the Department of Health has updated the group on this, and they haven't given a firm date until today, as far as I know. They told us it was in the pipeline, the contract was going to be signed, and it was imminent. So we're really gratified to hear there is now a date certain next week. It couldn't be a day too early. We get requests on a weekly basis from new patients who are not able to grow their own medicine or can't find a caregiver. In other words, patients who would need a dispensary to get their medicine. And they're asking us, so where do we get it? We heard about these dispensaries. So we keep having to tell them, unfortunately, they are not open yet. So now we have a little more certainty. And I heard Chad Blair talk about some of the other small roadblocks that could kind of crop up after
the testing.
The testing and some of the linking of other databases. We're not terribly concerned about those. I think the laboratories are ready to go. They've actually kind of delayed their opening in order to save money because they were waiting for this seed-to-sale tracking to get up and going.
But on the issue of money, we also were talking about a moment ago that for these eight dispensaries, because of these delays, they are, in their minds, losing money, and or at least not recouping some of their initial investments. Does that mean that we're going to see potential higher prices to the end user?
Possibly, possibly. And we understand those concerns. We pushed hard for a date of July 15th of last year for them to open. And while we did not expect that date, we did expect at some point in the calendar year of 2016 for the dispensaries to open for that reason, mainly for the patient's sake. But obviously, the people have to produce something for the patients, and that costs money. And unlike the laboratories, the licensees, they can't hold off. They have to rent sites. They have to get personnel. So they have to be kind of ready to go when DOH gives the green light. So they are losing money. So we're concerned that that will lead to higher prices. There are also bills in the current legislature that allude to taxation of the medicine once it is produced. So, you know, we're going to have to try to find a balance there in terms of the taxation and these kind of new costs because of the delay to make sure the medicine is not overpriced.
The issue of taxation was always one of the sort of selling points of this, but usually in the context of a legalization conversation, not one for those who are getting medication.
Correct. And I think when the dispensary system was created, there were a lot of different tax rates bandied about at the legislature. Some were very high, and obviously that would be really detrimental to the patients. So we did manage just to get the general excise tax and the GET for the medicine. But now we're seeing some new proposals when it comes to taxing. And if that's going to be impacting the price of the medicine, we'll probably be quite concerned about that. But in terms of the legalization, that's a wholly different thing. States that have legalized cannabis and that have medical cannabis have different taxation rates for those.
Let's talk a little bit about an issue that is certainly on the forefront of your legislative agenda, decriminalization of cannabis possession. We've talked so much about medical marijuana, mm-hmm. and yet for those who are arrested for having, a fairly small amount, that's something that can stay with them for a very, very long time. It can prevent them from getting jobs. It can prevent them from getting housing. And yet there are lots of people who are also arrested for alcohol abuse and don't have those same consequences, which has been part of your argument as to why we ought to look at decriminalization. What explicitly do you want to see happen with decriminalizing cannabis?
Well, I think it's long overdue that Hawaii joins the majority of states that have either decriminalized cannabis or now legalized it. And the reasons vary from state to state. Some states would actually throw people in jail for the possession. We don't do that anymore, but you do get arrested, about 800 adults per year, 600 juveniles on average are arrested. This takes resources from law enforcement to do the arrest, the booking process. There's a pretrial process that some of them wind up in OCCC. Many can't make bail. So they may not be convicted and stay in prison for cannabis possession, even though there is that possibility theoretically. But there's a whole burden on the judicial system and those individuals on that end. But then later, with a conviction on their record, all this whole host of collateral sanctions go into effect. And there are hundreds and hundreds of them that are listed. And they range from federal student loans to public housing to all manner of jobs. And this stays on your record forever. So it's very problematic for these individuals whose lives are ruined. I'm a law student currently, and I just filled out my federal student loan application. The last question when I submit that is, have you ever been convicted of any illicit substance offenses? It's pretty clear when you get to that page that you don't want to lie about that. So I can just imagine the number of especially the young people who are impacted. And I think it's really way past the time for Hawaii to join states like Mississippi and California.
And what about the paraphernalia, too? Because that's another issue. It's not just having the marijuana, but
correct.
When you've got other stuff, that can also get you in big trouble.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest problem about the war on drugs in general is there's a whole panoply of different offenses that law enforcement can use to criminalize people. Now, cannabis possession is a petty misdemeanor in Hawaii, but it still has those consequences I just mentioned. Drug paraphernalia possession, however, is a Class C felony in Hawaii that can carry up to a 5-year prison term and a $10,000 fine. So even more, even stronger consequences for the individual caught with some kind of paraphernalia. Now, that applies to people who have paraphernalia. I mean, it's a very long list. It could be anything from a baggie to a needle to a pipe to anything that is a scale, anything that is connected to drug use. And I think prosecutors argue they need that as a kind of an additional thing to prosecute people for if they can't find something else to get someone for. So it's other states have also decriminalized that type of offense. And I think, you know, we need to stop criminalizing the individuals who use drugs. And if they need treatment, we need to get them to treatment.
Which goes back to the whole idea that we've been talking about for a while concerning harm reduction. But do you have some tangible dollar figures that this would save the judicial system to have to be able to augment your argument?
So in terms of the cannabis possession, we're hoping that the Legislative Reference Bureau has conducted a study pursuant to resolution last year that will put out some dollar numbers in terms of what savings for the judicial system and administrative system could come into effect. In terms of something like the drug paraphernalia law, you know, you're winding up incarcerating people for years on these types of offenses. And as local papers have reported, this costs up to $10,000 to $20,000 per year per prisoner. So we're talking about potentially millions of dollars of savings there.
All right. Well, we're going to wait to see what the other study shows, too. But thank you so much for joining us. And we'll be talking to you as session continues.
Thank you, Bethan.
Carl Berquist is the executive director of the Drug Policy Forum of Hawaii. He focuses on ending the criminalization of drug users, improving the medical marijuana dispensary and registry programs, and combating the opioid epidemic. He's also, as he mentioned, pursuing a JD at the UH Richardson School of Law evening program.
Bert Lum here.
And Ryan Ozawa of Bite Marks Cafe.
Keeping you up to date with tech in Hawaii.
Starting on February 14th, Bite Marks Cafe and other HPR-produced talk shows will be moving to HPR One.
Right, that's The Conversation, Town Square, The Body Show, and Bite Marks Cafe all joining the news programs on HPR One as of February 14th.
Check out the new times for these and other programs at hawaiipublicradio.org and sign up for station emails while you're there.
Speaking of Bite Marks Cafe, I've got Bert Lum on the line to tell me about what the tech sector can expect from the legislature this year.
Yeah, you know, I just recognized that voice that you just played.
Haunting, wasn't it?
What's going on?
Yeah, that's you.
Hey, wow. So, Chris, the legislative session is in pretty much full swing. So we thought we'd have a couple folks come on and talk about what some of the policy initiatives are for this session. So we invited Robbie Melton, who is the CEO of the High Tech Development Corporation. So she's going to come on, and along with Rep. Mark Nakashima, and he is the chair on the House side for economic development. So we wanted to ask them about some of the things that they are spearheading and what they see as some of the policy issues that might be put forth with this 2017 legislative session.
Well, what's your best guess, Bert? What do you think is going to be top of mind, as you folks say?
Well, you know, depending on who you talk to, there's a number of different initiatives going on. And I think from Mark's side, we want to find out maybe what's going on in terms of some workforce development and some concepts around, you know, job creation. And of course, on Robbie's side, there are some tech parks, you know, being proposed. There's the sandbox over in Kakaako. There's things like tech hire. They just got a new, I think, a pretty good size grant from the Department of Commerce on the tune of $2.5 million for manufacturing to help, you know, their manufacturing initiative. So we'll talk about that and how maybe some of the, you know, the bills might be supporting that.
Looks like there's some good things on the horizon. Thanks a lot, Bert.
Sure thing.
That's Bite Marks Cafe at 5 p.m. In today's Backyard Quiz, we remembered an influential newspaper whose press run spanned the 19th and 20th centuries. It's remembered as a voice of the ruling oligarchy whose heyday saw the overthrow of the monarchy and the establishment of the territory of Hawaii. When King Kalakaua began to oppose the kingdom's pro-American, pro-annexation sugar interests in the mid-1870s, this paper began to attack the king in print, questioning the amount spent for his coronation, opposing his efforts to revive chanting and hula. It threw its support behind the 1887 Bayonet Constitution and condemned Queen Liliuokalani's later protests against the monarchy's overthrow. When a trans-Pacific cable was completed in 1903, the paper took full advantage of the new technology and published news stories from around the world transmitted through Associated Press cablegrams. The Hawaiian Gazette went under in 1918, but not before it had made its mark. And nobody got that today, but that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000. The 2017 Literacy Leadership Conference and student celebrations are February 6th through 9th on Kauai, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Oahu. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Dr. Samuel Ohugon's role as senior scientist and cultural advisor to the Nature Conservancy of Hawaii puts him in a rare position at the intersection of formal science and indigenous cultural knowledge, worlds of learning that have too often been kept apart in separate silos. He's about to join the Polynesian Voyaging Society's Malama Honua Worldwide Voyage, where for a short spell he'll serve as naturalist and cultural authority, and he's with us in our studio. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning, Chris. How are you today?
All right. I got to thinking about this whole thing about, you know, the separation of formal science with indigenous knowledge. And in the past, Western, whatever you call it, formal science has often overlooked what could be learned from people on the ground in areas it studies, yeah?
Well, there was this era of enlightenment that was represented by by Western ways, and anything else would be savage and pagan and primitive.
Yeah, that's right.
To be set aside, and enlightenment was to be brought to these people. There are exceptions to that, of course. You know, the Western botanists that visited Hawaii, for example, were really interested in the Hawaiian names of plants and the like, but by and large, that wasn't reflected by the majority of sciences.
And in the process, a great deal of knowledge was overlooked, or at least delayed in being brought to the people, to the wider world, right?
Oh, that's very true. I mean, when you think about Captain Cook's first visit to the Hawaiian Islands, and he noticed how immediately that the language in Hawaii was essentially the same language that he encountered in Tahiti.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, 2,500 miles of distance between them, and he didn't think
how do you
explain the similarity of language without the idea that there was frequent travel between the two.
Because as you mentioned, the enlightenment, which seems more and more of a misnomer as time goes on, but it was enlightenment thinking was, what could I have to learn from naked savages, right?
Mm. And so, you know, the idea of Hokulea now going around the world to share the idea of Malama Honua, to find out from each place that they visit what people there do in their place. What is their relationship to their place, and how do they value? What conservation actions are they engaged in?
Yeah.
And is there any place that we could find that would offer us the magic bullet for dealing with our conservation issues in Hawaii and globally? So as Hokulea re-enters home waters, right? They came out of the Panama Canal at Balboa on the west coast of Panama and entered the Pacific Ocean again for the first time in, oh gosh, years.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one of the crew dipping their ads into the Pacific Ocean and bringing it up and bringing it to their nose in the traditional honi, the greeting,
mm-hmm.
to say, we are back. And that was a wonderful image. But Nainoa's idea is now that we're back in home waters, it really isn't a matter of can we make it home. It's pretty much known that we have the skills to bring Hokulea back home.
Yeah, that's been established.
But each landfall that we encounter in the Pacific now represents a new milestone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Galapagos will be the first oceanic islands touched by Hokulea after leaving the Panama Canal. And, of course, the Galapagos, textbook examples of evolutionary biology,
yeah.
right, of the process of adaptive radiation on a volcanic island isolated from the rest of the world. And, of course, Hawaii also, with its amazing biota, you know, 90% endemism that is not found anywhere else on Earth, and the generation of biological diversity and form and function and ecology is just remarkable. So Darwin recognized this. He offered a reward to a naturalist who could bring him specimens from the Hawaiian Islands because he was interested in what our islands here at home could offer to his thinking in evolutionary biology. He never made it here, and I don't think anybody took him up on his offer.
But the parallels between the Galapagos and the Hawaiian Islands have to do with their isolation and the fact that, as you say, what is it, endemism?
Yes.
The fact that most of the species are endemic and did their all of their evolving here. Is that what that term means?
Yes, it does. And so, you know, some people say that Darwin's finches,
right?
Remarkable changes in their bill shape according to what they environment that they found, their seeds, insects, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they adapted their bill shapes in order to deal with those different kinds of foods and habitats. And the Hawaiian Islands, our Hawaiian honeycreepers, did much the same thing, but to an even more remarkable extent. There was a recent publication that showed that among the finches, there's a certain cluster of bill forms and shapes.
Right.
And the Darwin's finches, the Galapagos finches, exceed that in certain dimensions. Mm-hmm. But the Hawaiian honeycreepers just went off the charts in all directions, you know, to huge, graceful sickle shapes for feeding off of flowers or
yeah.
short little insect eating bills, gigantic bills for crunching through large seeds and the like. And not to mention the colors, red iiwis and green amakihis
yeah.
and yellow, you know, mamos and the like. Darwin might have actually been bewildered by that. He might not have recognized the relatedness of all of our Hawaiian honeycreepers. They looked so different from each other. The saving grace of the Galapagos finches was that, by and large, their body shape and color was the same kind of drab browns and blacks.
In a way, there was less evolution going on.
Yes, and so he was able to discern
yeah.
their relatedness with each other and then notice that the bills were different and then work that into his theory. If he had gone to the Galapagos, learned about that kind of adaptive radiation, and then come to Hawaii, maybe he would have recognized the...
I like to think it would have led him to another plateau in his revelation, because the similarities being that in an isolated environment, Galapagos or Hawaiian Islands, it becomes a sort of enough of an enclosure to be able to study, right? That the animals that evolved here stayed here, so you don't have a lot of interference. You know how science hates.
A controlled experiment.
A controlled experiment. That's the phrase I was looking for. Yeah, exactly. But that's kind of what Hawaii has been in its evolutionary history.
Yes. And so the Galapagos is an amazing place to compare and contrast those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike Hawaii, Galapagos never had a human population until recently. And interestingly enough, because that human population there now is relatively small, and because it almost all is driven by the economy of people visiting the Galapagos Islands in order to see the biological wonders there,
it's been preserved.
Each of those citizens fully recognizes where their bread and butter comes from.
Mm-hmm.
They can see that to preserve the natural environment in the Galapagos is an amazingly good thing for them. And so they're all for all of the conservation that's in place here. That's a little bit different in Hawaii, right?
It's a little bit different
yeah.
in Hawaii, yeah.
You know, a lot of us have been separated from the natural world here, right? We go to Costco and get the food that we need to eat.
Sure.
There's no longer this intimate attention to what the world in Hawaii tells us. And in ancient Hawaii, that was a completely different thing. The same kind of intimate attention to the waves, the stars, the clouds, the living birds of the ocean that allowed Hawaiians to traverse huge distances across the ocean is the same kind of intimate attention that Hawaiians had on land. And so Nainoa says the next renaissance is not the renaissance of saying that Hawaiians were superb voyagers. The next renaissance is Hawaiians were superb naturalists, ecologists, and landscape managers, should be and can be again. And that is the, if we can recapture that in the next decades, then Hawaii is truly a model for conservation of the world. You go from the canoe and how you behave with each other and with your resources there to the island and how you behave with each other and your resources there to our planet and how we behave with each other and our resources here.
It makes sense to me, Sam. Won't get an argument out of me.
Well, on our way home, the spotlight will be turned back to the Hawaiian Islands and the lessons that we've learned going around the world and how we apply that once Hokulea returns.
Thanks a lot for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks, Chris.
Great pleasure to talk to you. Dr. Samuel Ohogon is a senior scientist and cultural advisor to the Nature Conservancy of Hawaii. He's about to join the Polynesian Voyage Society's Malama Honua World Voyage in the Galapagos Islands. And you can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Ray Cruz here. You know, we're all part of some community, whether it's your neighborhood, your sports team, or your island. You're also a part of HBR's community, a community of over 190,000 listeners who tune in every day for the news and music they depend on. We depend on our entire community, too, and are asking each of you to pitch in and do your part at whatever level you're comfortable with. Become a sustaining member today by going online or giving us a call during business hours. Thanks.
Beth Ann, I'm so jealous of Sam being on his way to the Galapagos Islands. Can you imagine anything more wonderful?
I wish people could see your face. Yes, it was a wonderful conversation that you just had with him, too.
Well, it's about the lessons to be learned from people who have been in place for a long time, and that those are not to be ignored, right?
And the Galapagos certainly is a good place to be looking at some of that, too. That's going to do it for us for today, but we're going to come back with you tomorrow. And, of course, we all wonder where Hawaii is going to go educationally. But there are some comparisons to other states, other things that states are doing that might have some import for us. We're going to talk with Sarah Shelton. She's the Associate Director of State Relations for Education Commission of the States. And we'll be comparing those education initiatives.
And we're going to be hearing some avant-garde music from Scarlet Crow. We like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or BKOZHPR.
If you missed any part of this show or there's something you're just dying to hear again, you can always find that on our website. You can go to hawaiipublicradio.org. Just look under talk shows for the conversation.
I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.